Number five, and we are in the San Diego room, so you all know that you're in the right place. Carrie Miles is going to be giving the paper on eternal love, the biblical model for marriage. And in the little blurb, it talks about not only work, but soar. And I said, I commented to her, I had certainly noticed the work in the Bible, the biblical model, but I hadn't quite ever picked up the soaring, so I will be very interested to see what she has to say. Carrie is from San Jose. She's an organizational consultant. She's married. She has two children, and the biblical studies apparently are a very interesting sideline for her. Molly Banyan will be the respondent. She's an attorney from Seattle. She says she's not doing attorney work now except for family things. Busy with children and grandchildren. She has four children and two grandchildren. She's a Relief Society teacher. I forgot to ask you what class you taught.
The third Sunday, whatever.
Oh, the whatever. Okay. And she's been on the dialogue board for years. So without further ado, I'll just give the time to Carrie and we'll learn about the soaring part.
Oh, there I go.
We'll soar if we don't manage to kill this microphone.
Yeah, right.
I read a book recently called Modern Sex. Now, that's probably too early in the morning for that to get your attention. But one of the contributors is a man named Roger Scruton, and in one of his chapters, he said something that piqued my interest because it related to the work I've been doing with the Song of Solomon, and in general what the Bible says about marriage. And Roger Scruton is a baby boomer, and like the rest of that generation, the 60s generation, he was encouraged to experiment with different kinds of sexual arrangements other than marriage. Now, this wasn't really his natural inclination, but he said he was darned if he was going to miss out on all the fun. So he participated in some of these experiments. And he eventually married when he discovered that his experiment in cohabitation had become a commitment. Unfortunately, the marriage failed after just a few years because he discovered our years of cohabitation had disenchanted our first love while offering no second love in place of it. His distinction between the first and the second love, I thought, was an interesting one. And by first love, he doesn't mean like your first crush or the first person you love, fall in love with, but he means romantic, passionate, sexual love, truly, madly, deeply kind of love, the sort of love that we would all feel cheated if we died without ever having experienced. But what he found, and what I'm thinking that the Bible is telling us, is that this kind of love isn't enough. It's wonderful, we need that love, but we also need a second love. To capture that second love, first love, to domesticate it, to make it something that we can live with, and to let passion endure, or to let our ardor for each other endure when our passions fail. And surprisingly, the Bible recognizes our yearnings both for the romantic, passionate love and for this more enduring ardor for each other. And this is truly eternal love, and that the Bible teaches that no earthly power can destroy it. I'm going to start out going through the Bible with Jesus. And it's good to start with Jesus because we're going to end with him too. But Jesus was approached by some Pharisees who wanted to know about the grounds under which a man could divorce his wife. They wanted to talk to him about divorce. But Jesus refused to talk about divorce and talked about marriage instead. And he said, "Haven't you read that in the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they two will be one flesh. And they're no longer two, but they're one." So Jesus says this is the ideal for marriage. And he's pointing us to Genesis 2, back to the creation account. So let's go with Jesus back to there. In the Genesis 2 account, God begins the process of creating humanity by making one creature. Now, the Bible, your Bible probably translates this as Adam or the man, but the underlying Hebrew is Ha-Adam, and it's from the Hebrew word for the earth. So this first creature that God creates in creation is the earth creature. He's this creature taken from the earth, and there's only one. This isn't a proper name. It doesn't mean male necessarily, but it means the earthling or the earth creature. And having made just one, now before in Genesis 1, whenever God created, you know, the light or the dry land or the animals, he would end by saying, and the Lord God saw what he created and said it was good. Well, God creates humanity by starting out with this creature of the dust all by himself, and he says for the first time, this isn't good. It's not good that the earth creature should be alone. I will make a help meet for him. So we're going to start out now with the creation of humankind, with the creation of sexuality, with the creation of marriage, by God creating a help meet for the earth creature. Now, the help meet has been corrupted in English. In Hebrew, the word is ezer kenegdo. And in the King James English, the help meet, which is actually a very good translation, got corrupted to help mate, which sort of sounds like nonsense, but it sort of sounds like playmate. It sounds like this little thing that God created to help the man. More modern translations will translate this as helper. But both of these have the connotations of inferiority. A helper is someone that you hire to wash the dishes or dig holes, right? And certainly the helpmate is kind of a diminutive kind of thing. But in the Hebrew, there's no connotation of inferiority. In fact, the ezer kenegdo is a wonderful thing. The ezer means a help, and it's someone who can help or aid. It's more like going to an attorney when you need help rather than hiring someone to dig holes. Okay, so an ezer is someone who can render real help. And it's used 21 times in the Old Testament, and it always means a help from a superior. Most of the time it's used to refer to God himself as our help. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. I lift my eyes to the hills, whence cometh my help. The Lord my God is my help. Okay, so this is the same word here that God uses to describe what the earth creature needs. He needs an ezer. He needs a help. Who can really help him? The kenegdo, the second part of this that's translated meet, means suitable or fitting or corresponding to the help, the earth creature. So what God says he will make for the earthling is a help that is like the man. And in the next step in Genesis 2, I think this is quite charming. God's already created the animals. He brings them all to the earth creature, to Ha-Adam, to look at them. He's looking for a help suitable for him in there. And this very poignant kind of passage, Ha-Adam names all the animals, and then it says, but for the man, no ezer kenegdo is found. No help suitable or fitting for him is found. So the Lord God causes the Ha-Adam to fall into a deep sleep, and while he's sleeping, he takes part of Ha-Adam's side and closes up the place with flesh. And then the Lord God made a woman from the part he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. And the man's joy in finding the ezer kenegdo is apparent in the manner in which he greets her. And a more literal translation about what the man says on seeing his mate for the first time is, this one at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She isn't an animal, She's what he is. She's part of him. Bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh. This one at last. Here at last is someone like me. So when God creates sexuality, it's a force that draws the two beings together, but it's a force of likeness. They are attracted to each other. The man rejoices in the woman because she is like him, because she's suitable for him. So what the creation account, this first ideal of marriage, really stresses about the man and the woman is that they're alike, and that's what's so wonderful about them. And then the creation account goes on, and this is the verse that Jesus quotes, "For this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." So here we have another couple of elements in eternal love, that they leave their father and mother, the man leaves his father and mother, and is joined to his wife, and the one flesh ideal is the ideal for marriage there. And then the account goes on, "And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." Okay, so we have a couple more elements here. As we talk longer, we'll see that the being naked and not ashamed is more than just the fact that they're physically naked, but it refers to their relational state as well, and they feel no shame. So these are the keys to second love, to eternal love, and we see this right there in the creation of the man and woman and the creation of sexuality and marriage. Unfortunately, the very next verse in Genesis is Genesis 3, and within 10 verses it's all over. The man and the woman are fall. They're at odds with each other, with God and all of creation, and they have to leave the garden. But fortunately, there is another book in the Bible that shows us how to love each other as if we were back in Eden, as if we're back in that garden where the man and woman were without any cares or sin. And that's the song of, it's usually called the Song of Solomon. I think that's a mistake. I'm going to call it the Song of Songs as I go through. And the Song of Songs is a song. The title means the greatest of songs, the Song of Songs, or a poem. It's not an account of something that literally happened. It's not history. Okay, and you have to apply tools of poetic interpretation when you're understanding the Song of Songs. There are two characters in the story, the lovers, whom I call the woman and the lover, and a chorus of voices. The woman is the main narrator of the poem, and she begins it by addressing us directly, kind of drawing us into their circle of intimacy, and captures immediately the longing that makes the first half of love so compelling, by saying, "Oh, that he would kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." It's a very beautiful love poem. And as we follow the love poetry in the beginning, we follow them through this courtship dance of first love. Okay. And in fact, theologians have been so embarrassed by the Song of Song that for a couple thousand years they kind of spiritualized this. Well, this isn't about human love at all. It's about the love between Christ and the church, or Israel and God. And then in the last 100 years, maybe, people have focused on it more as an erotic poem. And certainly the first half of the song is really enmeshed in this erotic first love. It's extremely romantic, fairly explicit in some ways. She initiates the relationship, he pursues. They lavish each other with impossible praise. They just adore each other. No discretion at all. They sing of their passion and longing for each other. He asks for her commitment. She kind of comes and goes. And when she finally comes to her decision, we have this really interesting little vignette where she says, "All night long upon my bed I searched for him whom my soul loves. I tossed and turned all night." And so she finally decides that, yes, she wants him. She's going to commit herself to him. She gets up, goes out on the dark streets of Jerusalem, searching for her beloved asks the watchman she encounters, "Have you seen my love?" And she finds him, publicly proclaims her love, and takes him home to her mother's house. Okay, he's leaving his father and mother, right, to his mother's house. And when at last the lovers come together, their love is consummated, the lover proclaims that his longing has been fulfilled far beyond rational expectations. He says, "I have gathered my myrrh with my spice, I've eaten my honeycomb with my honey, I've drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." It's intoxication of first love. And so we have this abundant love drunk consummation of passion. And it's just this wonderful thing. And the Bible tells us it's this wonderful, beautiful thing. Now, this is where the fairy tales and the romantic stories and the Hollywood movies are going to end, right? You don't really want to go too much farther, because what happens with that wonderful, consuming, blind love 20 years down the road? You know, we're a little worried about that. This is where, you know, Scruton talks about that's the first love. Are you going to burn that up when you actually live together? We don't want to see that burned out Hulk. But in the Song of Songs, the first half of love takes us not quite halfway through the poem. Okay, we haven't reached the center of the song yet. And the rest of the piece elaborates on the second half of love. Now, this is where I think the people who've looked at the song in the last 100 years have missed it, because there's something that occurs in the center point of the song. It's very chiastic in structure. That changes the whole nature of the poem. And those who see this as just an erotic poem miss that, and so they can't understand what's going on in the second half of the poem. The second half begins with a vignette, which parallels the first vignette where she goes out searching for him in the middle of the night. Okay, in this one, the woman is dreaming of her beloved, and he comes to the door. Okay, "I was asleep, but my heart was awake. I heard my beloved knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night." Okay, so he comes to the door and says, "Oh, my beautiful beloved, you know, my perfect one, let me in because my hair is wet." And her response is, "I had taken off my tunic. Am I to put it on again? I had washed my feet. Am I to dirty them again?" Now, she'd been dreaming of her beloved, but she's kind of annoyed when he actually shows up, right? She doesn't want to let him in because getting up is going to dirty her feet, and she's going to have to go through this whole bedtime ritual again. Now, this seems a little self-centered, right? But actually, it captures a very important truth about what happens once we begin living together, once we have consummated that exciting, passionate first love, and we actually begin to begin life together with this other person. The lover has praised her to the sky, and he's just now called her his perfect one. Now think back to the last time that someone thought you were perfect. Were you in that big of a hurry to disabuse of that notion? No, this is perfectly rational what she's feeling, and I think we all felt it when we, you know, we're first married, first living with another person. I remember before I got married, I thought, well, you know, what do you do in the morning when, you know, you don't look too good and you don't smell too good, and here's this person who thinks you're wonderful, and, you know, you both dash for the bathroom at the same time. There was a letter in Ann Landers a couple of days ago where someone wrote, "Oh, I met this wonderful man, and he really loves me, and I love him. And he keeps telling me how beautiful my blue eyes are. And the problem is I wear blue contact lenses and my eyes are really brown." And how do I tell him that I don't have blue eyes? Okay, how do we deal with the disillusionment of first love? And not only is she worried about him seeing her not quite beautiful and perfect, but he's kind of messy himself. You know, he's showing up. This isn't an heroic plight. This is an epic love poem where she's sheltering him from some danger. right? He's in need, but he's wet, you know. He's damp with the dew of night. So this is first love's crisis. We have to admit that we are not perfect. We have to trust the other person to accept us, and we have to accept the other person in their messiness and lack of perfection. And I think this is what the creation account means when it says that the ideal love is naked. It's honest, it's open, it admits what we really are. It's beyond the grooming and the embellishments of courtship. And the Roger Scruton, who I began with, that living together burns up first love. Marriage involves adjustments to the petty annoyances of living with another person. Maybe he leaves his toothbrush on the bathroom sink. She doesn't wear a beautiful lingerie to bed, but some old ripped up t-shirt. He sleeps in his jockey shorts. And these little disappointments, they're not a big deal. They're not anything tragic. But they do dull that romantic edge. These little disappointments. And we lose our expectations about our beloved, our expectations about ourselves, and our whole romantic view of what love is going to be about. So what happens next in the song? She says, am I supposed to get up and let this guy in? And have to face all these things. The next part of the song said, my beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. He rattled the doorknob. Okay. And my womb trembled for him. I arose to open to my beloved. Okay, so he rattles the doorknob. She says, my womb trembled for him. And I got up to let him in. Well, she lets him in because her womb trembles for him. And those who interpret this as just an erotic poem say, well, this is an expression of her erotic desire for him. Okay, but the Old Testament uses the trembling womb other places, and it doesn't mean erotic desire. It's used often for God expressing his love for Israel. And what it means is motherly womb love, the love of a mother for the child, of God for creation or Israel. It's compassion. My womb trembled for him is expressing compassion. Okay. So now the grace that the lover grants the beloved is this compassion. And now she's going to open the door to let him in. So we have the introduction to the first love of the beginning elements of second love, which is self-giving, caring, concern for the other person, for the other person's sake. And this changes the whole nature of the relationship and the whole nature of the poem. Now with compassion, it's safe to be naked and not ashamed. Okay, we see now how this ideal established in creation becomes possible because we care about the other person. Eros, of course, the passionate love is more about desire. When we say, I love you, in the midst of passionate love, we're saying, I want you. You know, I want you for what you are to me. It's concerned about her eagerness, his prowess. Now we love each other, we care about the other person. A few hundred years later, the Apostle Paul is going to say the same thing in his letter to the Ephesians. In Ephesians 5, he tells people to be subject to each other, be subject to each other out of awe of Christ. And subject is a difficult word. It's also translated submission sometimes in English. Being submissive has very bad connotations in English. But the Greek word used here means to put yourself under. Okay, and this is in the middle voice, so it's something that you're doing voluntarily. So we're to voluntarily put ourselves under each other out of awe for Christ. And perhaps a better way to translate this would be to support each other, yield to each other in marriage. Don't try to take the superior position. In short, to be compassionate, that we are to be compassionate to each other in marriage. Be naked, honest, not puffed up, and allow our lover to be also to create a place where it's safe to be vulnerable and unguarded. And in fact, in the end of Ephesians 5, Paul quotes the same passage that Jesus does. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two will be one flesh. So both Paul and Jesus point back to this creation account as the ideal for marriage. Okay, well, going back to the song, though, there's danger in this. There's danger in being naked and in yielding, putting yourself under your beloved. In the song, the lover has left by the time the woman gets up to answer the door. Okay, he rattles the doorknob, she's moved by compassion for him, she gets up to let him in, he's gone. Okay, so we have a repetition of the scene where she goes out in the dark streets of Jerusalem searching for her lover. And she meets the city watchman again this time, and this time they beat her up and they take away her mantle. They take away her defenses. So in this we have the last surrendering of her defenses to the man, but in consequence of this, she's beaten up. She's bruised. And I think this also points to a very real truth about the nature of compassionate love, the second love, or eternal love, and that loving and caring opens us up to the possibility of harm. Okay. Maybe when our beloved sees us as we truly are, they won't love us anymore. Maybe that guy really won't love that woman when he finds out her eyes are blue. Okay, that's always a possibility. But also, our lover is vulnerable. Now, he has become naked. And this offers us a new source of pain, because love, caring for somebody else, makes us vulnerable to all of their weaknesses and concerns and anxieties. Okay? When my first child was born, I was never so frightened in my life, because I'd never loved anyone who was that helpless before. I still choke up, he's 20 years old. But I'd never before loved someone who was that vulnerable and helpless. It's frightening. When we care about someone else, we suffer when they suffer. We hurt when they hurt. And we carry the burdens of each other's bad choices, of their vain ambitions, their anxieties, their illnesses. And even though we're promised eternal marriage, eternal life, we're still going to die. And we have to deal with that pain too. And when we really care about someone, we're open to all of that. So what do we do? What does the Bible tell us to do? Well, in the song, the woman accepts these vulnerabilities, and she just goes on. That she doesn't try to control him. She doesn't try to solve his problems. She just goes on loving him, caring for him. And in fact, she says to the friends, the chorus of voices, "If you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love." Okay. Paul also tells us to deal with our vulnerabilities by telling us not to use compassion against each other. Okay. Now, when the song is written, people are out of the garden, right? The fall has happened. By the time Paul is writing to Roman families in the first century, we're really out of the garden. And patriarchy is in full flower, and the only real people are the wealthy citizens class, and everybody else exists to serve them. Now, he's just told these people to submit themselves to each other, the men as well as the women. And he says, don't use that compassion against each other. So the husband is to love his wife as he loves himself, and to sacrifice his own will for her sake. And the wife is asked to respect her husband, even though he's sacrificing his masculine prerogatives and expectations in this world. Note that also in the Song of Songs that the lover himself did not harm the beloved. She comes to grief because of him. She suffers for his sake, but he himself does not hurt her. He does not wish any harm on her. So the Bible is not condoning abuse or telling you to stay with it when he's treating you badly or beating you himself. Okay, the woman hesitated to open her heart, and she paid a price for that exposure. But with the acceptance of the fears and concerns of second love, it flings open the gates to Eden. They're really back here in the garden again. And the friends say, now after she's been looking for him, the friends say, "Where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your beloved turn, so we can help you look for him?" And she replies, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the bed of spices, to browse in the garden and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved's is mine. He browses among the lilies." And the poem has earlier established that she herself is the garden and all spices and the lily. Okay, so it's this beautiful coming together here in the song. Now, our modern culture tells us that we cannot do this impossible thing. Our modern culture tells us that second love is too dangerous, that sexuality is the possession of the individual that must be expressed in all its fullness regardless of the effect on the relationship, that we can't be dependent on another person, that we can't yield to another person. Men who are dependent are kind of comical, treated as being kind of comical, or even maybe a potential stalker. The women's movement for the last 40 years has been telling women, don't be dependent. How can we do what the Song of Songs and the Apostle Paul and Jesus and creation is telling us to do, which is to be one flesh, which is to yield to the other person and be naked and undefended with them? How can we not only trust and depend on, but adore, to soar with this other person who has weaknesses and who may hold our weaknesses against us? And the song shows us, it goes on to talk about, "I'm my beloved's and his desires for me. Come, my beloved, we'll go forth to the fields. We'll spend the night in the villages. In the morning, we'll go to the vineyards. And we'll see if the vines are budding, if their blossoms are opening, if the pomegranate trees are in flower. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes bring forth fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, new as well as old. I have stored them for you, my beloved." The lovers can trust each other because our abundance transcends the sexual. It transcends the material. The lovers in the song express no concern about any need. They have everything in simple abundance. They never do any work. The woman is called lover, bride, daughter of a nobleman, but she's never a housewife. Okay. The man is called beloved, bridegroom, and king, but he never acts the part of a husband. He never worries about anything. He does no work, provides nothing. But despite their lack of industry, they have everything: all fruit, wine, spice, and freedom. The first verse of the Song of Solomon, a Song of Songs, calls it Solomon. So the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And this is why it's called the Song of Solomon often. But this description did not mean to imply that Solomon actually wrote the poem, and nor is Solomon the lover. But the poem alludes to the legend of Solomon throughout the poem in order to contrast the wealth of Israel's most glorious king with the even greater riches of love, of eternal love. And as you read the song, you'll see that, you know, Solomon did this, but we have that. Okay? So Solomon is this ruler possessed of enormous wealth and power and many, many wives. But he's shown in an earlier passage of the song that he needed men with swords to protect him from the terrors of the night. At one passage, we see Solomon's bed, beautiful gold-paved pavilion. But he's attended not by a lover or by friends, but by men with swords to protect him from the terror of the night. But the lovers need no defenders. They carry no sword. And unguarded, they go where they please, and they sleep outdoors in beds of henna blossoms under the cedar trees, and the air is floating with exotic spices and intoxicating perfume. The woman calls her lover a sweet-smelling sachet, and he lies all night between her breasts. And to him, she's all sweet and tasty things, the lily and the garden. He is pure gold. His name is oil poured out, this image of voluptuous wealth. So which would you choose? Would you choose to own the most precious things in the world or to have your beloved regard you as the most precious thing in the world? Okay, this is the choice that the song offers you. The song is a poem of love in the garden, and it's easier to keep your vineyard in blossom when life is one large vacation. But this is exactly the point, that we realize our true abundance and fulfillment in unity and mutual concern, not in the pursuit of other wealth. Love, the song tells us, makes life a long vacation. And it's telling us where to place our priorities. On love and relationships, not material striving, not achievement, possessions, consumption, power, or reputation. Because in the end, the drive for these things are nothing more than the drive for love anyway. So why not just skip to that? So the Song of Songs, which is this erotic love poem that people wondered how in the world it got into the Bible, in the end offers a very biblical message that love and relationships, not material strivings, offer us an even greater wealth than we know how to crave. And in fact, Jesus uses the imagery of the Song of Songs in the Sermon on the Mount to make the same point. And he says, "Behold the lilies of the field, they toil not, neither do they spin. Yet Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the fire, how much more will he care for you?" Okay. So the Song of Song then, as in creation, portrays the woman as the Ezer Connecto, the help fit that makes the earth creature whole and that makes life worthwhile. She provides and protects and is his only one, all he needs. But the protection she offers is not that of the sword, but of the comfort and abundance of her devotion. In the end, second love asks us to not only be passionate and adoring, but also committed and compassionate, fearless and trusting. And then safe with each other, we can release our anxieties and find peace. And naked and unashamed, safe in each other, art becomes a thing of stirring power. We've already seen how it provides for all the lover's needs. The next passage in the song, just, I'm really going to lose this on this. It still makes me cry. I've been working this for a couple of years. But the woman says, "Set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death, jealousy fierce as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, a flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench, nor torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned." In ancient times, people used seals to mark something as their property or to do the equivalent of signing their name to say something is their will. These were emblems carved of stone or clay. And in ancient Hebrew thought, the heart conceived one's will or desire and the arm carried it out. And she says, "Set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm." Savor the beautiful ambiguity in that. She's saying, "Set me like my signature, your signature, on your heart, on your will, on your arm, which carries out your desire." Now, does that mean, when I say write my name on your heart, does that mean that your heart is mine or that I'm your heart? Okay, there's this beautiful ambiguity there. Does that make your will mine or do I only exist to do your will? Which is it here? If I am your heart, does that make your will mine, or is my will yours? As a seal on your arm, do I blindly carry out your bidding, or do you ask of me only what I desire? And together the lovers form this endless circle, this beautiful ambiguity, where they want nothing more than they want to be one with each other and to have that joint will. They want the same things. And within this circle, even jealousy burns not as a possessive paranoia, but as this elemental longing for exclusivity and just to be one with each other and to not have anything else intrude on that. So intertwined, joined together by God and by our own choice, by our own yielding, we become one in flesh, mind, and heart. And this fearless love, which once exposed the woman to danger, now makes them immune to all hurt or harm. For love is strong as death, jealousy fierce as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, the flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench, no torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. The losses that we will all eventually face pose a serious threat to any relationship. Our children struggle, a loved one becomes ill, we lose our job, our parents grow old. The Song of Songs, however, promises us that fully developed love indemnifies us against any material danger. God gives us marriage to provide the safe pasture we must have to face down the challenges to our peace. And when desiring only unity, we defy the power of material deprivation and the anxious lure of material wealth. Fire from heaven itself melds us together. Now no loss, not even the grave, can leave us bereft. Here then is eternal love, one flesh, naked and not ashamed. This is the second love that endures when the first love burns out. It's certainly not the love glorified by our contemporary culture, but this love, endless, immortal, eternal, builds marriage that will endure long after Hollywood becomes dust.
Good morning. It is a pleasure to be with people who have a passion for ideas and for spirit, and particularly for Carrie, because I think she's shown a great deal of both. I've taught gospel doctrine for 16 of the past 25 years. Song of Songs has never been mentioned in the manual. I always read through rather than around the text in defiance. You know, how dare you declare a redefinition of the canon? But it's been many years since I've studied the song to seriously consider its worth to me. And I must thank Carrie for the wonderful opportunity her thoughtful and wise paper has afforded me to look again at the beautiful song and acquaint myself with recent research. For 2,000 years, the song has been viewed predominantly as an allegory. The Targum, written between 700 and 900 AD, is typical of Jewish writings from the song's first inclusion in the canon in the first century. The woman was Israel, the man was God, and their story began with the Exodus and ended with the coming of the Messiah, plus a couple of other historical allegories. With that in mind, Jews still read the song on the eighth day of Passover. Maimonides' work in the 12th century offered a competing interpretation, substituting individual man for Israel. Levi ben Gershom, whose work has recently been reprinted and reviewed, followed with an Aristotelian explanation of desired union between God, man, and knowledge. It is labored, to say the least. Hippolytus produced the earliest extant Christian discussion of the song in about 200 AD. Surprise, the Christians saw the allegory as God, sometimes as Christ's relationship with not the Jewish, but the Christian church. Origen met with Hippolytus in 215 and studied under the great Jewish scholar Hillel. It is Origen, schooled in both traditions with his Neoplatonic and Gnostic belief in the incompatibility of body and soul, and his lifestyle so ascetic he chose castration himself, who established benchmarks of interpretation for Christians for centuries to come. Jerome and Bernard of Clairvaux carried on the tradition that the language of the song was so sexual it could only be interpreted as historical and spiritual allegory. In other words, the blatancy of the sexuality itself screamed of code. Not to ignore the Protestants, from whose ranks came the early Mormons, we note with interest Luther and Wesley differed little from the Catholics. John Calvin, however, joined the historical minority to teach the song was about physical love and appropriate for the canon. In the last few decades especially, the trend of scholarship, both Jewish and Christian, has been an exploration of the literal meaning of the text. That meaning is intensely sexual and material. The song celebrates sensual love in all its flavors, sight, touch, smell, sound, and toward all its objects, flora and fauna of rich variety. The sensuality of such popular translations as the King James purposely downplay the sensuality of the original. I would suggest that if you want to read the song, you should read multiple translations simultaneously. For example, in the King James, a Hebrew word which specifically means sexual love in Hebrew is translated just love. Joseph Smith taught us to liken the scriptures unto ourselves. Few do with as much fervor and thought and wisdom as Carrie. I commend her. Her reading is personal and provocative. It's entirely appropriate to respond to the insights the scriptures lend to our individual lives, so long as we remain open to the possibility that while those may be God's messages to us and many others, at the time, they may not be the only insights or the insights intended by the authors. God uses scripture as well as many other avenues to touch our souls. I also find her understanding of the biblical importance of a marriage of equals convincing. Her concept that sexual difference serves to unite is profound. I find her argument for a deeper love than sex alone can express true, with a capital T. Carrie's analysis mixes old and new modes of study. She accepts the sexual nature of the poem and finds a broader, non-sexual meaning. Where I differ in my reading of the song and my understanding of its meaning for marriage is in a more literal reading of the text. I think the sexual nature of the poem is the broader meaning. The task of getting the Hebrew right, getting the translation into English right, and through it all, maintaining the poetry, can only be an approximation. I've read numerous translations and commentaries and note the very rational yet differing treatments. I'm left with a humble guess, likened inevitably to me, even when I am trying to be objective. My personal favorite translation is that by Block and Block, Berkeley Press, 95. Like Carrie, I prefer the New International to the King James, particularly because the former indicates the speakers. Unlike the second half as the first, even when in the second half, for instance at 7:13, the word for love relates to an emotional rather than sexual relationship, and that is one of the particular sections from which Carrie read, it's followed immediately by the scent of mandrakes, which she also mentioned, mandrakes being an aphrodisiac. Both lovers describe each other sensually, pursue one another, and relish their tryst in her garden and his nut grove throughout the poem. The crisis incident can be interpreted multiple ways, but I'm most convinced by staying as close to the text as possible. Open to me, my sister, my love, the moistness of his body, his thrusting his hand into the hole of her door, hand arguably being a euphemism for penis elsewhere in the Bible, and the door elsewhere being a clear statement of protection against sexual activity, if not virginity. And her reluctance to dirty her feet, feet being a euphemism for genitalia, both male and female, elsewhere in the scriptures. Approaching her door expressly for sex, and her reticence to engage in sex at the time. The literal translation for her reaction to his last move, thrusting his hand through the keyhole, is her innards stirred for him. Carrie used the translation, womb. Whether this is sexual longing as Block and Block, among others, translate, or compassion, as Carrie prefers, doesn't really matter unless one finds the two mutually exclusive. I don't. Mixing the emotional and the physical seems natural. More common than not, and I believe the poem does so implicitly and explicitly. Her love, perhaps both Eros and Agape, has overcome her hesitancy, and she moves to the door, but too late. It may be he urgently wishes to dry himself from the dews common in Judah at some times of the year, and it may be she has been ungrateful, selfish, and vain, but that reads a good deal into a text that more directly says, I want you, and answers, not now. The word for the tunic she wears indicates a dressy and fine garment, and even possibly an undergarment, so I'm not sure she finds herself less than appropriately attractive. She is crestfallen and enters an expression elsewhere used for dying. My soul failed at his flight, or my soul went forth, or I nearly died. Remember, too, that in ancient Israel, soul meant both body and spirit. The Greeks and the Gnostics, not the Jews, contributed the pernicious doctrine that the body and spirit could only be at war. The woman's abuse at the hands of the watchman exasperates but hardly daunts her. The poem glosses over the incident quickly and finally. It never is mentioned again. I'm also not convinced there wasn't a difference in the two incidents with the watchman. In the attack version, she wears a veil. the word for which is used only elsewhere in the Old Testament in Isaiah 3:23 to describe fashionable apparel worn by wanton women. The tunic garment noted above may be particularly seductive. Her dress could explain the attack. Nothing in the text indicates she's made to suffer for selfishness or vanity. I don't see her heart close to him at any point in the poem, and I don't see it more open in the second half than the first. Everywhere, these two adore one another and the world in which they find themselves. Throughout the poem, they take turns as the pursuer, and longing leads to pursuit, leads to discovery, leads to joy. There's little sense of time passing. The song may take place in days or weeks. It takes time and corresponding experience to develop all-encompassing love. Here I see no evidence of time, experience, or maturity. The lovers have no earthly cares other than a little sun exposure while guarding the vineyard, the watchman incident, and perhaps the threat of discovery, which is common throughout the poem. They speak only of love, and the love of which they speak is almost exclusively that of sexual attraction and fulfillment, only in two ways other than as physical pleasure alone, three times in warning and once philosophically. For example, in Teaching the Young Women, she warns of the power of love. Quote, swear to me that you will never awaken love before it is ripe. And the quote, love requires readiness beyond gonads. Philosophically, late in the poem, in what some think should have been the final stanza, we find, for love is strong as death, jealousy fierce as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, a flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench, no torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. These caveats made, the song relishes the physical. Oscar Wilde once said, those who see any difference between body and soul have neither. I'm not sure all that Wilde had in mind with his clever ditty, but to me it speaks of basic Mormon doctrine. All is material. Spirit is material. Material is good. The earth is good. The body is good. Sex is good. Marriage is good. The sheer newness, the curiosity factor of a beginning relationship must, as Carey says, develop into a commitment capable of weathering storms large and small. There are physical attraction alone cannot carry the weight of a full life. There are brief intimations of that commitment in the song. Their love is faithful and exclusive. But from first kiss to last voice in the garden, the song remains intensely sexual. Praise be, for herein lies a truth and the text speaks to me. The relationship, which cannot sustain sexual passion as it takes on additional essential characteristics of love, is not to be envied. I love the song for the clear statement of God's blessing on sexual joy. It has been my experience that sexual pleasure softens the blows of life and binds husband and wife when the world would wrench them apart. The absence of sexual pleasure usually strains all other aspects of marriage. I don't want to de-sex the song, the only scripture to celebrate that truth. It's all we have. As Carey points out, we live in a culture most confused about love, sex, and marriage. Part of our confusion comes from the failure of religion, our own included, to accept even one book of scripture which boldly and beautifully celebrates the unity of body and soul and the natural affinity of the material and spiritual. Redemption is not about denying the body or discarding it for the eternities. It is about using the body for good, not evil, so that we may earn the capacity to use it forever. The song sings of that good.
Thank you, Carey and Molly. There is some soaring. That's wonderful. Wonderful to find that out. We have 5 minutes for questions, and what I'm going to ask you to do is, one of two things. You can either come up and ask the question, or I can tax you with making sure that you repeat it for the tape. It's very frustrating to buy a tape and have questions asked and not know what they are. So, time for questions. Go ahead, Karen. Questions?
No questions. Gee, that you really covered it.
Yes?
I have a comment more than a question. I was very happy that she mentioned that the Lord took the Adama, which is a female
known for earth, and chopped the ending off and made an Adam, a human being, or a creature. And that when he put the Adam in the deep sleep, he took a T-Z-E-I-L-A, Tzela, from, or which means, it's translated rib. Actually, there are four other places in the Old Testament, and it's translated side. So my question is, which side did the Lord use to make a woman? Left or right? Incidentally, Apostle Paul was a bachelor who advised people to stay single, as he was. His advice is probably still good, though.
What part of that am I supposed to answer? Any other questions?
Have you ever
The question is, have I ever taught this in gospel doctrine? And no, I haven't. Molly.
Molly.
Have you, Molly?
I have certainly covered that briefly. I've never made it a lesson. That made it real hard to just hold Molly.
Yes, and I intend, after relooking at it, to when we get to the marriage section in Relief Society to see, I intend to make it the subject of the lesson.
In talking about this, the compassion, introduction to passion in the second half of the poem, I don't mean to downplay the continuing importance of sexuality, and the sexuality is certainly still there, but I think it really comes, the fullness of sexuality in the broader sense of what sexuality is about, why we're sexual creatures, and what that meaning it has for us as whole human beings, comes about with the development of the compassionate theme too. Yeah.
Have you ever talked to anyone? You can repeat it for me.
Okay. Okay, how do they teach this in Judaism? I love to talk to Jews about this because they sing the song at weddings. It's set to music. And so they're not afraid of that passionate element in the song. But the last Jew I talked to said they regarded it as being kind of saccharine.
Oh. There's still a lot of dispute. Orthodox Jews still have a very hard time with the sexual nature and really view it as allegory and become quite defensive sometimes when you talk about the sexual. And I've done that just recently in reviewing this, whereas conservative and reformed Jews are much more open to the wider interpretation. There is a tremendous range of opinion.
This is another section here.
Go away.
Someone keeps trying to open the door behind us. Yeah?
I was wondering if you could comment. It seems to me that there's been a neurotic tendency ever since St. Augustine came up with his original sin idea. And sex equals sin equals sex has been the formula, and they've defended to divide and put it aside. The clergy has had a heck of a time. Here was a perfect God making a perfect world, theoretically, and you know, here's something that's dirty and nasty, and celibacy is a much higher spiritual level, you know, this kind of... two or three centuries they wrestled with that. They finally took the wives away from the priests, and then the concubines, and they made them celibate after that. But we still have... in our society, it seems to me, a tendency to try to divide the physical aspects of love from the civilized intellectual and put one on a different plane. I don't think you can divide them. I think they are combined. I can only speak from experience, but I look at my wife when she looks at me with eyes of love, I melt inside, just like I did just 60 years ago.
Yeah.
That's a good thing to end on.
Okay.
Time's up. I'm going to ask you to clear the room quickly so the next group can come in and get ready. Thank you. Thanks, Jerry.